Thank you everyone for joining us today for this Lowy panel on China's prosperity and what it means in China and what it means to the world. My name's Meriden Vural. I'm the director of the East Asia program here, and I will shortly give you an introduction of our eminent co-panelists. But first, I just want to, of course, start with an acknowledgement that this event is being held on the traditional land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay respect to their elders, past and present, and to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander peoples who are in the audience today. So thank you for coming. We're talking about this issue of prosperity, and prosperity seems to have been almost an obsession of Xi Jinping's over the last year. He's used it when he's been talking to his domestic audiences, and he's been using it when he's been talking to international audiences about China's role on the world stage. It's been a huge theme of his. So, for example, initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative are being framed in terms of how it's China's way of boosting the common prosperity around the world. At home, China's the vision of a Xiaokang Shihui, the moderately prosperous society, not too ambitious, by 2020 is a strong theme. So what does this all mean in practice? Can Xi and the Chinese government achieve these visions of prosperity? What happens if they do? What happens if they don't? So that's what we're going to discuss today, and I'm joined by two eminent experts to help us talk about that. Linda Jaivan is a cultural commentator, an essayist, a translator, and a linguistic expert. I think that's true. And Linda's done incredible work on understanding Chinese culture. She's written 11 books on China.
No, 11 books.
Yeah, you've written 11 books. Not on China. Okay, 11 books, some of which are on China, including a book called The Monkey and the Dragon, which is set in the 1980s, but also essays, for example, in The Monthly, which look at these political issues like China and Australia's relationship and this question of influence in the Xi Jinping new era. Jane Golley is also at the Australian National University Centre of China in the World, where she is the associate professor and an economist. 2 decades of research on various aspects of the Chinese economy and demography, including regional development, education and income inequalities, such as the one-child policy and gender imbalances, and also an expert on the Belt and Road Initiative as well. So that'll be very handy for us as we discuss that today. Linda and Jane are the co-authors of this lovely shiny red book that you can see over here, the big red book. This is the ANU's annual China in the World yearbook. This is the sixth or the seventh? The sixth publication, the sixth year of it. It's free, so please feel free to take a copy. It's our gift to you, well, their gift to you. And it's a terrific read of what's been happening in China over the last year, particularly on this theme of prosperity. So I really encourage you to take a copy because it's a really good read. So let's get stuck into it. Can you tell us a bit about this obsession with prosperity that we've seen in China over the last year in particular as a guiding principle, both domestically and internationally? Let's start with the domestic context. Where's it cropped up? Who's been using it? In what kind of situations has it been coming up? Linda, could we start with you to tell us about that domestic?
Sure. It has been a big theme for a long time in China, really since Deng Xiaoping decided to launch modernization, economic reform, and an open door to the outside world. Open door to the outside world very much linked to economic reform and modernization in his thinking. We've seen China grow in prosperity. It has got more of a consolidation in language as prosperity, as Xiaokang Shihui and so on. In recent years, China, the China dream of Xi Jinping is very much around this concept of a moderate prosperity for all, as well as a strength, a Chinese strength in the world that's predicated on prosperity. I'll just leave it there for the moment, but I'll return to that.
I might add, in terms of the numbers, I'm an economist, so you know, Deng Xiaoping had clear numbers about what level of prosperity he wanted China to reach. In 1980, he said that in 20 years, so by 2000, he would quadruple per capita income, and he actually managed to do that by 1996. These days, they're less likely to talk about specific targets. In fact, it's just been in the last couple of years that you don't ever hear about China's national growth rate target for the year. They have they target around 7% and they achieve 6.9 or 6.8 or 6.7% every year as they start to bring that down. But I think, you know, the question of can they achieve moderate prosperity, we don't really know what that means, right? And I don't know that they particularly do either. I mean, you would have poverty, complete poverty eradication on that, you know, as a way of measuring that, and he's certainly set that target. And, you know, the way that they've gone with that in the last 40 years is just incredible, and you've got a pretty good chance of reducing the poverty numbers. You've got about another 100 million or so that they need to lift above the absolute poverty line, and that'll be one way of measuring success. But, of course, they can also always change the goalposts as well. You know, they've got an urbanisation plan. I always think this is a good example of how you can achieve a target, that by 2020, 100 million more rural Chinese will be given or will be classified as urban. So that makes it the biggest ongoing urbanisation process ever. And what they can do with that is either grant hukou status, you know, this household registration that just enables you to become urban by definition. But of course, when you're the Chinese Communist Party or a powerful government, you can just also redefine the boundaries, and they will achieve that goal, like they achieve on paper pretty much any of the goals that they set out to.
And just to add a statistic to that, in the early 1980s, China's poverty rate, people living under $2 a day, was over 80-something percent of the population, and now I believe it's 5.6% of the population. So that's a huge advancement in general prosperity, even if 5.6% of 1.4 billion people is still a lot of people. But there's the economy. We're a really good team. But there's just something else to mention before we dive into, I think, China's contemporary prosperity and language around it and all of this, and that is that there is another word that comes up in language, and that is shengshi, and that's slightly different from xiaokangshihui. Shengshi is a prosperous age. It's not about the society as such and the people's living standards. It is about the entire age, and it encompasses a notion of cultural glory and national glory. The most recent famous Chinese shengshi, prosperous age, was in the Qing dynasty, the Qianlong emperor in the late 18th century. And it's interesting to note that the Qianlong was one of the most successfully expansionist of emperors. He was the one who incorporated the Xinjiang and really made China's land mass much, much bigger than it was before, consolidated China's rule over a much larger area. And that was the last shengshi. It was also a glorious age of cultural achievement of all sorts of things. So I think that's something that is also in the back of people's mind when they talk about prosperity in China.
Right. So this is a connection between this idea of prosperity, whether you're talking about it in the age of prosperity or in the sense of a prosperous society, and politics, because there's a reason, there's some sort of domestic imperative, isn't there, for this kind of language to be used and this kind of, you know, this focus to be had. So can we talk a little bit about what those domestic political imperatives are for this kind of way of understanding what is success?
Legitimacy.
Well, I mean, that's the bottom line. The party stayed in power, like all governments, because they deliver to the people what they want, and they've understood that to be rising standards of living that's come with not just GDP growth, but per capita GDP growth, and then, of course, that needs to be shared in some way across the population. And so the biggest problem, really, that's arisen in the last, I'd say, four decades is income inequality, and Xi Jinping's not the first one to be aware of it. I mean, he knew it would happen. He famously talked about how, you know, some people and regions would have to get rich before others and they would all prosper eventually. That was exactly the language he used. And he actually predicted that the turn of this millennium would be when that needed to happen. And so then the people who followed him, I mean, Jiang Zemin and then Hu Jintao, started to talk seriously about rebalancing the economy. You know, this is something that's been talked about in policy terms since the early 2000s. He didn't get very far. It didn't really go that well for Hu Jintao. Has about a decade of trying to rebalance the economy, and so and particularly trying to level out some of those income inequalities across regions, but also probably most prominently between those people who are connected to the state and those people who aren't. And you can start to talk about corruption if that's what you want to call it, but there are different levels of guanxi, of these connections that allowed some people to prosper. And at his 19th Party Congress last year, so Xi Jinping coming into his second term, second 5 years as leader, he identified the number one contradiction facing China as this uneven and unbalanced development. If you want to put that really simply, basically it's about if you have 300 million people who start to think that it's really unfair that you've got 609 billionaires, the most in the world, then if you can't control them internally, and they've got some pretty good mechanisms for trying to do that, but if you can't, you're going to get social unrest, and rising social unrest threatens the populace, so let's start talking about prosperity and make everyone feel better. And it sounds a little bit like here.
And that's totally connected to the international agenda. I mean, we've seen China come up as a global citizen in with leadership in areas like climate change. It contributes the most number of personnel to UN peacekeepers and the second largest financial contribution to UN peacekeepers. There's a whole bunch of things like this. But this is all part of a narrative that it's good. It's Chinese prosperity acting as the good citizen in the world. There's, you know, other things as well. But there's also an important narrative of strength that keeps people, that the party uses to address the discontents that Jane was mentioning. So if you have a proud nationalist narrative, China is strong, we're all part of a strong China, then people have less legitimacy to raise these objections internally, because China has, in the Communist Party narrative, promoted very, very heavily since the patriotic education campaign that followed Tiananmen in 89. Shortly after that, they launched a patriotic education campaign which has very much succeeded. It's worked because China, the party controls media, education, and so on. So it's very easy to get a message out there that you have a unified message. And the message is China suffered humiliation at the hands of all of these imperial nations and so on. It was the poor man of Asia, all the sick man of Asia, all this sort of thing for so long, and it's the Communist Party that has brought it to this particular prosperous day. And therefore, if you're not as rich as the guy with all the great connections down the street, at least you can be proud that you're Chinese. And this is very much part of the cultural message that comes through in things like a uber popular, like mega popular movie called Wolf Warrior 2 that came out last year. And the tagline of the movie is basically, you know, whoever offends China, it doesn't matter how far away you are, we will kill you. it's a very friendly message. But it is, that's literally the translation. And the kill, because there's a number of different kills in the Chinese language, this one is actually the judicial one. This is actually the one that a court sentences you to death. That's the particular character that is used in that particular one. Because there's also Sha, which is just, you know, I kill you. So it's very, very interesting how the nationalist rhetoric and the nationalist sort of pumping up of nationalism is used in part to address some of the discontents within the prosperity narrative.
So that's a really good way to look at it, that this idea of prosperity is as this kind of overarching theme to address and mollify discontent and an ultimate project of achieving and maintaining party legitimacy, and that the national domestic project of prosperity is a key part of that, but the interlinkage with the international project of prosperity, that they can't be pulled apart. And that's not only, it's partly, but not only because international prosperity is going to help achieve Chinese prosperity, but there's also this image of strength that is in itself a huge part of legitimacy for the party. So let's move on to this to the international side of things. So we've seen a lot of talk by Xi Jinping as well as others, you know, the Davos Forum speech in January 2017 and the Boao Forum speech more recently, and a lot of other things in between, the BRI Forum
Xi Jinping's been talking a lot, very publicly, at these big international on these big international stages about how China's got this important role in global prosperity. And sometimes he's explicitly said, in opposition to the US, which is an unreliable global leader now, which is convenient political messaging, but sometimes that is just very, very strongly and implicitly implied. So how does this work in the sense of this international narrative and this domestic project in terms of what prosperity means for China and for the rest of the world? Maybe we can start with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Belt and Road Initiative. Thank God acronyms were invented. And to have a little look at those and how they fit into these narratives.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll talk a little bit about the Belt and Road Initiative and the way I describe it. And that's my chapter in the book is the Belt and Road Initiative, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I've been thinking about this a lot really throughout 2017 with the election of Trump, which we write here. And, I mean, I keep reading the same line everywhere. It's like Trump has been such a gift to China. And that's what's caused Australia such alarm is that, you know, we used to have America... And we've had at least half a century of successive American presidents upholding the liberal international order or the economic, the rules-based global order. There are a whole bunch of different words that we use for that. And Xi Jinping, I would say curiously, you know, got to be the one that stood up in January last year and said, I'm the one who's going to be I'm the champion of free trade. That's how he was reported. I'm the one who's going to protect this because America instead is looking inwards and, of course, talking about American jobs for American people and America first and closing down the doors wherever he can. And, I mean, we fast forward a year and Trump has actually gone and delivered on that. You know, the world's economists are furious. We don't sort of agree about much, but the one thing that we agree on is free trade, right? You can almost not find an economist. It is the fundamental premise on the whole discipline that you do what you're best at and you trade with each other, and that's going to make the world more prosperous. And so now Xi Jinping gets to stand up and be that man. And the Belt and Road is his attempt. It is what I call a geo-economic strategy, the use of an economic tool to try and win people over. And, you know, depending on where you're sitting, if you're sitting in Pakistan or in Laos and you've got the wealthiest government in the world offering to help finance, I mean, not the government directly, but through state-owned enterprises, through state-owned construction companies, that you'll get relatively cheap loans to establish railways and roads and bridges in remote parts of the country, thinking that you might then ultimately connect in and enjoy some of the global prosperity that China clearly has, how could that be a bad thing? I mean, it's a bad thing when you're sitting in Australia. There's a lot of people panicking. How's China going to use this badly? Are they going to force all this money on Pakistan and Pakistan will have a whole bunch of corrupt, you know, broken down trains? I had someone just say to me the other day, oh, but, you know, China's done all that high-speed rail there. There was that terrible accident. It's going to go badly. There probably will be a few high-speed rail accidents, but China's spent 30 years building up its infrastructure, and I reckon they do it pretty well. And if you contrast that against Donald Trump, I mean, he's not actually offering the region, if we can, you know, even just focus on the Asia-Pacific region, he's not only offering nothing, he's walking backwards. You know, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership was at least an offer to his friends. They deliberately left China out of it and played a pretty strategic game. And he immediately, within days of his presidency, withdraws from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and kind of looks like he's walking away from the region altogether. And just on Friday, he's, you know, whilst slapping tariffs on everyone, including us if he could have, but he's, you know, had a little let's make friends, keep your closest allies happy, and we won't put that steel tariff on Australia. But, I mean, he's putting tariffs on everyone and then turns around and says, oh, well, I'll negotiate the TPP, I'll renegotiate that as long as you give us a better deal. Like, he's always on about what's in it for them and nobody else. Xi Jinping at least... And let's be clear, this is all for domestic reasons that you talk up a global game, that you talk up your global power. They want to rebalance the economy. Actually, reshifting infrastructure, for example, towards their western periphery makes sense for them in all sorts of geostrategic ways that have everything to do with their domestics. But I reckon, you know, and I can get critical about Xi as well, but, you know, this is, I think, a brilliant piece of foreign diplomacy because pitted against the other superpower, you know, who would you rather be friends with? That's a rhetorical question.
I mean, it is... you know, brilliant from the Chinese domestic perspective as well, because the BRI is taking it. A lot of the projects are using, making use of the overproduction of steel and so on that would have otherwise slowed down the economy. Is that correct, Jane? I always have to ask her on economic questions. but it's, so it actually benefits China in many different ways, geoeconomically, geopolitically, but also in terms of keeping what's going on in China's own industrial sphere, giving it a bit of balance. There was something else I wanted to say about BRI, and I can't remember what it is, but if I remember, I'll come back to it. But I did want to make a point about rules-based order and why the Chinese laugh at any notion that the Americans had ever upheld rule-based order. Now, but first I want to mention something in the Global Times recently, which was saying, you know, basically China is the hope of the future and China can take advantage of it because, as it said, democracies are, and it used a weird word, I'm trying to remember, I think it was ulcerating or something. And that's very much a triumphant response to, well, not just, well, Trump obviously is a huge example, but you know, the rise of authoritarianism, generally, democracies are in a bit of trouble and China is gloating, which, you know, but in terms of rules-based order, I've been recently reading Michael Pembroke's History of Korea, called Korea, and it's very good. And what it made me think of was how when, after the Second World War, it was never the idea in any UN or other pronouncements or agreements or anything that Korea should become, the Korean Peninsula should be divided into two sovereign states. That was never the idea. The US pushed that against the will of all the other countries, pretty much. And it installed Syngman Rhee, who was a right-wing, violent, brutal fascist dictator. And it, when the Korean War started, North Korea came south of the 38th parallel and was pushed back with the help of Marshall MacArthur and so on. It could have ended in 3 months, just pushed them back over the 38th parallel. And that's where it was supposed to stop. And the rules were that's where it was going to stop. But MacArthur didn't care about the rules, and he explicitly went against any notion. So the whole Korean War, the three-year disaster and horror of the Korean War and the solidification of North Korea as a separate regime is all because, and also the involvement of China, China's feeling a threat from America, is all because America does not respect a rules-based order when it doesn't benefit America. So China has China, history is always present. We tend to forget history. China never forgets history. It's so important. The history of the Korean War is present in the minds of the leadership, and they think, rules-based order, don't make me laugh.
Well, they think that, but at the same time are prepared to use it. I've noticed that if you're reading about Xi Jinping in the context of this economic order, that they definitely won't use the word liberal economic order, but they'll talk about the rules-based or the international
without
economic order, and you can't put liberal into the sentence when you're talking about the ruler of a one-party state who's just changed the constitution so that he can stay in power forever. You know, if we come back to that rhetorical question, I think it's a very complicated one, but of who would you rather be friends with? The answer at this stage looks like neither. You know, I'm with Linda, and you might, you know, identify our political leanings if we both agree with that, but the Americans have done some appalling things. I mean, Bill Murray just today tweeted about how he was glad that they hadn't decided to go in and bomb themselves for various atrocities, you know, within the United States whilst they're out bombing Syria. They stick by the rules until it suits them. Unfortunately, China does the same, right? You've got this, but in a different way. I mean, and so the Belt and Road I always want to be really careful. It does look like the better of two options. If you're comparing it with protectionism, anything looks better. But this is still not them going out and practicing free trade in the way, you know, the fathers of economics taught it to us. This is them using state-owned enterprises. They have state-controlled financing that channels in money that's been extracted or from the poorest people in the population, and we come back to that question of inequality. They've had nowhere else to put their savings, so they've put it in the banks, and they're then going out and financing the 609 billionaires. You know, they've now got the highest number in the world. And so that's certainly not a happily ever after, let's just be friends with China story. But actually what I really think that it is, and I use Pakistan as an example, where you can say, oh, this is all going to go horribly, Pakistan's corrupt, there's going to be all sorts of problems that come out there. Well, what Pakistan needs to do is get its house in order. And there's a lot of people ready to point the finger at China and say China's going to come in and make all these mistakes and it's all going to go horribly wrong because of what China does. If we can prepare to respond to that, and here's the place to look for that, Australia's been dealing very effectively with China and with Chinese state-owned enterprises, for example, for two decades. There's no evidence at all that those state-owned firms have done anything in Australia that ran counter to them just being good capitalists. And so we've got a lot, you know, in our regulatory legal frameworks, we've actually got the capacity to handle that. If the Pakistanis don't, let's start helping the Pakistanis get their houses in order rather than pointing the finger at the Chinese and fearing what damage they're going to do out there. Well, we're not going to be able to stop them anyway, so that's the approach I'd take.
Right, and people in Australian government and Australian commentators have said more or less the same thing. You know, if your house is on fire or your house is in a bushfire zone, you can't necessarily stop the bushfire from coming, but you can build up the protection of your house. Anyway, so if we're talking here about, you know, some of the risks of China's prosperity push. If the Belt and Road Initiative is part of China's global prosperity push, but there's obviously potential for things to go wrong, not necessarily because it's designed to go wrong or because it's a nefarious tool of wickedness, but because Chinese state-owned enterprises or Chinese companies sometimes just get it wrong, make pretty big mistakes. They can certainly do that. What about, if we're talking then about, you know, making friends and influencing people, as you described the Belt and Road Initiative as trying to do, and this is sort of a part of this project of trying to build prosperity, which ultimately then comes back to China and Chinese legitimacy, what about what's going on with soft power and the United Front Work Department? How are they, these kinds of less tangible things, being used to try and make friends and influence people, build prosperity around the world and build the Chinese own prosperity?
Well, the United Front Department is the one behind the Confucius Institutes. It's behind a lot of, it will provide free content to, for example, Chinese language publications in Australia. It will provide all sorts of benefits to them. And so in an effort to influence both local, overseas Chinese populations, I'm talking about the overseas aspects of the United Front Department. United Front within China also reaches out to, for example, Christians, people from minorities, and so on. So I'm talking now about what it does is it does soft power. Now, some people compare it to, or it's Confucius Institutes and so on, to say the Alliance Française, that kind of thing. It's not that exactly, because the Alliance Française can still present all sorts of opposing viewpoints about France, French history, and so on. The Confucius is very much on Confucius Institutes are very much on track online, and the important thing to remember is the United Front Department, despite its humble sounding name, is directly run by the Communist Party. It's directly under the Communist Party's leadership. But Mao called it a magic weapon, a fabao, which is a wonderful term going way, way back, which was used, you know, monkey, Journey to the West? And there were things called fabaos in that story, little magic weapons. So Mao referred to it as a fabao, which actually helped the communists come to power through the United Front work with other with other parties and people who were considered patriotic but not communist. Now, Xi Jinping has also referred to the United Front work as a fabal, and that is a magic weapon to supposedly make everybody very, very happy about everything China's doing in the world. It doesn't quite work out all the time as China expects, partly because of the kind of ham-fisted nature of a lot of official soft power. What's very interesting is that you have things like Wolf Warrior 2 in Australia, and I've had a couple of Australian friends go and see it and go, oh, good action movie, but ugh, you know, and Chinese flock to it and see it here and are very proud. So there's a difference in perception. Who is this aimed at? That is part of, even though it wasn't conceived necessarily as a soft power project, because in particular that one projects China's hard power in a soft power form, which is a film. So it's a very interesting example. On the other hand, some things actually work. And one of them seems to be Chinese television serials in particular countries. So Russia, apparently, is very keen on them. Korea, South Korea, having exported a lot of their television serials to China, which really, they were so popular. The most popular thing in China on Chinese TV for many years were South Korean serials. Now, China's beginning to get some of its serials into South Korea. And I have a friend who works in audiovisual translation. I'm a subtitle translator for many Chinese films. I did another one very much like Wolf Warrior. It was called Operation Red Sea, and it's got a very similar message. So I do that, and my friends this friend of mine in audiovisual translation recently spent 3 months in Tanzania, because the demand for Chinese television series in Tanzania is incredible. And she was helping to train up Swahili translators.
Can I just add one point on the Confucius Institutes? And I've had a direct experience with it related to the book that helps you to start think about, or has helped me to think about these questions of freedom of speech and where you draw the line. So last year, our China Story yearbook was called Control, and they're all available online, but they're blocked in China. I don't know if this one's been blocked yet, but it will be blocked if it hasn't already been blocked. And the Confucius Institute, I won't name which one, but that asked us to do a book launch for them, and they knew what the book was. It had been available online, and within 2 days before the launch, they wrote and withdrew their offer to host it. And, you know, because we're not singing the party's praises in there, we're not going into China bash either, but we give a... It's not even a balance. We just give a sort of multifaceted view of all sorts of different aspects of China, some of which are good and some are bad. So in any case, I thought, you know, we were a little bit annoyed, I guess, and thought they played it badly. They should have looked at the book earlier and not invited us in the first place. That would have been the best move that they could have done. But meanwhile, the Chinese government is funding the Confucius Institute, and the universities across Australia have agreed to accept those institutes into their institutions. You know, for me, I walked away thinking I will never, I work at the ANU and you can hold me to this, but I will never support having a Confucius Institute at the ANU, because we have to uphold academic freedom. It's pretty much, you know, like The Economist has free trade. If a university doesn't have academic freedoms to say whatever we like, I say I'll criticise the Australian government probably more readily than the Chinese one. I need to be able to do that. It's my job. And so that didn't really go well for them on a soft power front, and a lot of countries around the world are starting to say no to that money. But it leads us then into the question of, well, if the Chinese aren't going to give us money because they don't like what we say, then we've got to get the money from somewhere else. And I actually think that's a better option than learning to toe the party line. If we start doing that here, then you start to get a real problem. But that has actually been overblown, I think, in this country in the last year, what they're actually forcing you to do. No one yet has forced me to do anything if I know what lines to stand.
So what we're talking about here is, it sounds like there's this Chinese efforts for creating a kind of global prosperity that serve its own purposes politically. I've been pretty patchy. The results are pretty patchy. We talked about, you know, some successes in Chinese soap operas, for example, and in various other fields, Chinese soft power or efforts are successful. But then by the same token, there seems to be a fair bit of resistance. So to the Belt and Road Initiative, to Confucius Institutes, to these sorts of things, there's resistance as well. So if we're looking at China trying to develop these, making friends and influencing people, creating a global prosperity and a friendly environment that ultimately comes back to itself, how's it going?
Well, I think we also have to stop here and go, China, we have to stop talking about China as a monolith. It's much more useful to talk about the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese government, Xi Jinping, and, you know, the current Politburo, than it is to talk about China, because then you begin to think of China as 1.4 billion people all marching in unison, you know, which is not true. It never has been. And it's similar to this whole notion of, I don't know if you've ever heard of panda huggers and dragon slayers, but apparently the world divides between them. And it's as silly as thinking, and you could only have that notion if you think that the Chinese, that China is one thing. It's 1.4 billion individuals. It's the Communist Party and its critics. It's overseas, people who are living overseas but still have a sense of some kind of loyalty or identification with China. It is so many different things, and we have to constantly remember that. I think it's really important. And just to give a little example about prosperity and how it's interpreted or responded to domestically, culturally. On the one hand, we've got things like Wolf Warrior 2, and we've got some really heavy-duty patriotic rap that basically threatens to do all sorts of terrible things to... it uses awful misogynistic and homophobic language against the West. There's some really vile examples of patriotic rap in China. You've got that kind of extreme of it, but you also have this phenomenon that's grown up along with prosperity in the last few years, and that is a culture that's known as Sang culture, or Buddhist youth. It's sometimes called Buddhist youths. And what it is are people who like it, it's this kind of slacker culture. So people who don't want to get out there and go to work and make a lot of money. They just want to hang out. One of the memes for Sang Wenhua is the comedian Ge You was in a series a number of years ago, in which he's this kind of absolute do-nothing who sort of plants himself onto a friend's couch and stays there. And there's a whole bunch of very funny memes from that show, and that does the rounds. Everybody's not everybody, but there's, you know, there are people who identify with that, or you call them Buddhist youth. They don't want to be part of this whole prosperity, everybody out there and doing things. So China is complex. The reactions to prosperity, the seeking of prosperity, it's not one story, and I think we have to constantly remember that in the way we speak.
On If You Are the One. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it, but it's a good excuse to work on your Chinese sometimes on SBS. And this long-haired hippie guy, I thought he looked gorgeous, turned up and he had his guitar on his back and he lived out in Lijiang, a tourist town, and he was just clearly, you know, my idea of a hippie. And he said, oh, I just like sitting around and drinking cups of tea and playing the guitar. Burr, 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 burr. Every light just went off so quickly, if you know the game. It was like the girls weren't going to have a bar of this, but, you know, things are changing in China. You might just meet a long-haired hippie if that was your cup of tea.
You can drink the cup of tea with her. So, now, come on, focus on the politics here, please. How is this working? How is it working out? Is the Communist Party and Xi Jinping's success and longevity assured because of their excellent, inverted commas, approach to making friends and influencing people, ensuring global prosperity? Is this something that's at least being bought by Chinese people?
I think a lot of Chinese people are buying that. A lot of Chinese people are... There was a whole theory when China's middle class was rising. There's now hundreds of millions of people who qualify as middle class in China. And when the middle class was just beginning and rising, people were going, oh, that's going to be a big force for democratization, for the end of communism and so on. And it hasn't turned out that way at all. It's been a big force for buying really great luxury goods on French shopping trips. It's been, it's changed the face of luxury tourism. Most, you know, it's done a lot of things, but it has not done what people predicted. if you have those things, then even if you have a Western education, you're going to go back and want to change China. You're going to want to be like a democratic country. It hasn't actually worked out like that. So in a way, the Communist Party has been very astute in positioning itself and its legitimacy on its ability to see people achieve this China dream.
But also remember that, you know, nothing particularly changed last year. I mean, there were a couple of things that changed. And again, if anyone saw Power and Influence, the show that was on the ABC, and just all of the rhetoric around how China's now using all of its newfound power in these kind of evil ways and reflecting that and kind of imposing it on the entire of the Chinese diaspora and everything else. We're talking about 4 decades of a transition here that was always premised on opening up and being engaged with the rest of the world. So that's an old idea. Xi Jinping did, you know, as you said, change the constitution and made himself a ruler forever. That was a pretty big change. But for 5 years, from the time that he first took to the stage as China's president in late 2012, he was adamant that Chinese socialism with Chinese characteristics was going to define what this country was and what its economy was. Well, they've actually been talking about that since the mid-1980s. Deng Xiaoping defined it and said, this is what China will be. Each successive president said, this is the system that we're living in, socialism with Chinese characteristics, expect a strong state, expect one-party rule, absolutely, you know, expect us to continue to own all of the land. So why I don't quite see why it was last year that we woke up and people suddenly started saying that, oh, suddenly we're dealing with this power that we don't know how to deal with. You know, that, and then I come back to Trump. The fear that's come out of America, and it also comes to answering your question, is about how is China succeeding or can China succeed? Will it succeed? Depends not entirely but largely on how the West and how America responds. You know, and Australia, I think, if I can sum up last year in terms of how we've treated China, it's to turn around and say, actually, you know what, we realise we don't like you very much and we don't want to be friends with you anymore. We've been talking about that friendship and we were fine with it, but now we're not. And it's really, you know, and if we push back with that, if we start going, you know, strengthening, if that's possible, our alliance with the US and strengthening our relationship with India, I mean, trying to call the region that we live in the Indo-Pacific, that seems to have happened, and it's a way of wishing China away, of thinking that they won't feel as seem as important if we change the name of the region that we've spent 3 decades trying to be a part of and doing a pretty bad job to a large extent. But, you know, that question is still there. What happened last year that was so significant, and why weren't we a little bit more prepared about it? You've had plenty of us talking about it for decades.
Just quickly, because we're going to open up to questions in a second. Yeah, thanks, Linda.
I think everybody has to understand, everybody suddenly gets surprised when China is a dictatorship or acts like a dictatorship. And, you know, in the constitution, the Chinese constitution, China is a people's democratic dictatorship. Now, some people go, what? But this actually has a logic to it, because the people I'm explaining the official ideology, the people in this sense, the Renmin, are the majority of the actual people who are good and patriotic. It doesn't mean 1.4 billion. It means those in the 1.4 billion, the majority, who are good and patriotic. A democratic dictatorship means that the party exercises dictatorship in the name of the people, democratically, over the bad elements. I'm not making that up. That is literally the explanation for China's government. Its official government is a people's democratic dictatorship. And the sooner that we all come to understand that strange phrase, the more we will be able to understand how China moves in the world and manages its own prosperity.
Thanks. I think we'll have to open up to the floor, the audience now. So when the mic, we've got a roving mic, so when that comes around, can you just state your name and your affiliation and just a quick short questions, please? Thanks very much. Okay, we'll start with up the back.
Hi, thanks, Jane, Linda. That was a really interesting panel. Frances Kitt from the Lowy Institute. Jane, I was really interested in what you said about Xi Jinping and socialism with Chinese characteristics. It's been going on for a long time. But I'm interested in how that pairs with continuity and change in Xi's China. he's done a lot of different things, and whether that's part of a strategy to, you know, what do you think that's part of?
I've always stressed the continuity more than the change, and I'll go back to the early 1980s, as I've already listed the characteristics that Dunn laid out of what socialism with Chinese characteristics would be, and she's stuck to those, and it's talking about state ownership, state planning, but most importantly, one party rule. So it's fairly broadly defined in that sense, and there's a lot of scope for movement within. Now, there's no doubt that she's clamped down on various aspects, I'd say more of society than of the economy in recent years, although in terms of the economy, just one example is capital controls. You know, we're talking about a country that's still got about $3.5 trillion worth of foreign assets, you know, held abroad, and they're spending the money on the Belt and Road or in Africa or in Vanuatu or wherever it might be is a part of that. But when he decides that he wants that money to stay internally, not him on his own, but with the People's Bank of China, he's got mechanisms that can prevent that money from flowing out. And we saw quite a few shifts just last year where he's like, we don't want all this hot money flying in and out of the country, so we'll stop that from happening. That is something that you can do in a system that you call socialism with Chinese characteristics. You can't do it if you live in or you define your country as a neoliberal country that has perfectly a perfectly floating exchange rate and perfectly mobile capital that can go anywhere. And what's changed is that China's now much more confident to stand up and say, you know what, your methods really didn't work all that well for you. You know, take a look at the global financial crisis, and if you can remember it, take a look at the Asian financial crisis. This was about capital flowing freely, and it buggered a lot of people up. So let's clamp down and, you know what, suck it up, because that's the way we've been doing it. Don't get, you know, frightened about it now, and yet we are.
Art Griffin, writer, entrepreneur. On a micro level, as people get wealthier, they realise that they can only have so many things, and are they turning, as we do in the West, to more spiritual things?
There's a growth of all kinds of religion, both legitimate and illegitimate, because the Communist Party can decide what's not legitimate. And also to things like, there's a slightly utopian back to the farm movement, which people going to live a simpler life, embracing simpler clothing and so on. The Chinese Communist Party doesn't quite know what to do with that one. So there was a guy who was, I can't remember which, one of the southeastern states, and there was a little area there. His name escapes me right now, but he was leading these people there. And then suddenly everything kind of stopped, and I don't know what's happened. But there are those people going to Tibet, for example, to actually absorb some of the Buddhism and all of that. Han Chinese going to Tibet. There is a bit of that.
Of influence developing, like a Chinese Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie?
Not allowed. Falun Gong. Yeah. See Falun Gong.
They're not allowed, but we do have a story in here about the rise of psychotherapy, you know, so it takes some people a while to realise that money doesn't buy happiness, but so there's a boom in that industry as people are trying to figure out why they've got everything that they thought they wanted but are still miserable. I actually thought you were going to ask the question which people have always assumed, and it's one of these awakenings in the last year or so, is that China was going to become more like us because as people got wealthier they would necessarily push for democratic reform, you know, for those sorts of freedoms. And the party's very clever like that. I think they let some things in around the edges, but yeah, you're not going to stand up and start talking about anything too spiritual. You'll be lumped with the Falun Gong and in a fair bit of trouble pretty quickly.
Question just behind me.
Elise Mackay, I'm an investor with a fund here in the city. And one of the things that is very interesting is the debt levels in China. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, Jane, about prosperity and debt, what you've seen has changed perhaps over the last 12 months in this edition.
I'm not going to help you make money because I bet you know more about it than I do. But, I mean, I sort of come back down to the numbers. You know, the last numbers I remember seeing about the levels of debt might have been around the 11 trillion renminbi mark. I'll get you to do the sums of where that is in US dollars. I don't know what that number is now. It's very, very hard to measure. Debt's high, not the highest in the world, and I still think that when you've got this commanding government at the centre, and again, I don't want to suggest that Xi Jinping could just draw in all of those foreign assets and pay it off, but I'd rather probably have China's debt situation and the wealth of their government there as a potential, you know, bailout than I would probably have the United States level of debt, you know, which is beholden to China and where that money can be withdrawn from them and cause all sorts of troubles. So, again, you know, I don't know where to go and invest the shares tomorrow, but I think the debt problem, I can easily be proven wrong tomorrow. That's the nature of crises, that you didn't predict it because you didn't know it was going to come. I mean, there are serious problems with how the debt's been handled, but I somehow put my confidence in the Chinese government to find ways to prevent that from becoming catastrophic.
Hi, I'm Charlie from the Lowy Institute. Do you think that at the official level, a narrative of militarism, 强军思想, is replacing a narrative of economic prosperity? And if so, what are the implications of that at the grassroots level in China?
I don't think militarism is replacing the economic thing. I think China's becoming more assertive about what it believes its rights are in terms of the South Sea Islands, obviously, and so on. But it would never, I don't think, the Communist Party is going to embrace an explicit narrative of militarism that takes over from, because it goes against all of its other rhetoric in global relations and so on, and it would be to its detriment. I can't see that happening, but I can see this, you know, you get militaristic films and you get militaristic actions, but I don't think the rhetoric is going to replace that anytime soon.
I absolutely don't. So the dragon slayers or the hawks, whatever you might call them, would love us to think that there is a growing militarism that would replace the economics, but actually this is where I see the contrast again between Trump and Xi is so strong, is that America used to have both, but their militarism is just so powerful, and that's what they seem to turn to first of all, and they're playing this kind of geopolitical military-style battle with China, where China's coming in and playing an economic game. And that's what I call this geoeconomics that I've been talking a lot about in the last year, because it's like you're not even playing the same game. You can't expect to win. At every opportunity Xi Jinping and the party get, they talk about being non-confrontational, you know, non-expansionist. I mean, they've got so many economic problems at home. This is back to this 1.4 billion people that they need to control and keep happy so that they don't riot and revolt. They don't have time to be thinking about the rest of it, except for in preparation for dealing with being a risen power, and that's what they are. So they have to have some responsiveness. I think it's understandable that they would choose to expand their military bases, for example, as a kind of defensive strategy. And then, of course, I'll be called a panda hugger for that. Maybe they are actually plotting to use those new bases, like in Djibouti, to turn around and take over the world. But I reckon they got enough going on at home to not seriously want to worry about that. They want to be our friends. They want us to do trade and investment with them so that they can keep their people happy. I'm a bit biased, but it's still all about the economics for me.
And the US, I think, since World War II has invaded something like 50 countries, had military actions in something like that many countries. And China, for all of its island building, which is not to say I think that's a really great thing, the island building, you know, in terms of world peace and all of that, but it has not been going around invading other countries. I mean, that's just a simple fact, and there's no sign that it's about to start.
Hello, my name's Matt. Just in line with that, how do you feel or believe China will therefore address the countries that have resisted the One Road, One Belt policy, like through the Malacca Straits and so on? They haven't really had great success through there. How do you think they'll address that?
I think they'll probably have to take it as it is. I mean, it's happened in Australia, right? We rejected their offer to formally align with the Belt and Road. There's a lot of people thinking in government all across Canberra, really, about the implications of it and trying to understand exactly what its motivations are. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that the only motivations are economic. There might be other ones, and then we need our security analysts, for example, thinking carefully about what those security impacts will be. But I think when a country like Australia says, we're not interested in joining with you, how do they deal with that? They've got plenty of other places to go and send their money to, and we're witnessing exactly how they're dealing with that just this week with what, you know, the newspapers are reporting as the Great China Freeze, likening it to the Cold War, and they've just managed to cancel a whole bunch of high-level diplomatic visits. You know, that's the starting point. The end point, I think, when we make them unhappy, is that we'll pay pretty high economic costs. And the example that I've been giving for a while now and that I'm sure we'll see next year is a drop in Chinese student numbers to the universities. They'll have their ways to say, we're not happy with you. Does that mean we should therefore kowtow and let it in? You know, because they've got to be really careful qualifying these days. As Linda said, you know, the branding of us, of the people talking, we can so easily become sympathisers, or Communist Party sympathisers, or whatever it might be. We have to figure out what we're prepared to accept and what we're not, and that takes a comprehensive, you know, analysis beyond the economics. I mean, in this particular case, I think it's a pretty bad idea that we're pushing them away on the Belt and Road, and I'll come back, and it relates to the story of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, where we chose to sit out, and the economists all through that year were saying, what are you doing? If you want to have some impact or influence on the governance structures of a bank that is Chinese-controlled, but the Chinese were there quite explicitly saying, we want to contribute to the global good, we're willing to set up governance structures that comply, you know, with global, with the rules-based order. And the Australians ultimately, once the British came in and a few others, we joined in and affected it from the inside. And that just seems totally logical to me. Whereas to stand it back, say we don't like the look of it, and not join in, you go and let them do far more potential damage, you know, go to the Pakistani case or wherever it might be. And not only that, but don't ever forget that we're a capital-hungry economy, and we always have been. And China's sitting there with the money. They got trillions to spend, and we're short. So push them away. It's like, where are you going to get the money from? Let's start talking about, I mean, I'm perfectly happy. I'm not that kind of economist. I can start talking about lower jobs and growth, because I'm not going to run for the prime ministership.
Okay. We're just running out of time. I might get two last questions, which I'll get together.
Yes, my name is Chou Xie. I'm a student at University of IR, University of Sydney, sorry. Yeah, so my question is that, is legitimacy the only reason why the CCP is doing everything, including the BRI project, etc.? Because, like, in China, like, at least the central government has a very high level of public trust and confidence. So is that a misunderstanding, or like, is there more to it?
Hi, my name's Ian Lin. I'm one of the original ABCs in Australia. My parents came here in 1929 and had five children. My father was one of those overseas entrepreneurs, and we always beat the Westerners because my father had five employees free of charge. But I think the Western world is questioning the present form of Western democracies, because it's a very short term, it's about political power, economic power, very short term. I was interested in your term, okay, a democratic dictatorship. Do you think there's a future for Western societies? It seems like we've got to change our form of government, but do you think there's a future for a democratic benevolent dictatorship?
Okay, my very quick answer is I hope not. Because I think that the idea that a dictator can decide what is good for the people and what is not and who are the good people and who are not the good people is a very frightening idea, because they don't always make the right decisions. On the legitimacy question, is a very interesting question. I think the Communist Party, the interesting thing about prosperity is that, and China's entry into so many global areas of market, relations and so on, is in the 21st century, why do you need a communist party to lead when the essential relations economically are market-based? Why do you need a communist party? It's that legitimacy thing. It's the thing about, we have restored China's pride. We can make China strong. only we can do that. This is the thing. You don't need a communist party to run a 21st century state. That's why the legitimacy question comes up.
I actually quite like the idea of a democratic dictatorship, but as long as I'm the one who's allowed to choose the dictator.
Oh, that goes without saying.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've got an incredibly complex picture of an incredibly complex China. I hope you've enjoyed today. Thank you so much for coming. Please don't forget to take a copy of the book. Thank you. Thank you very much.